I'm Jeffrey Church from the Department of Political Science at the University of Houston. This is the Political Theory Review, a podcast of conversations with authors of recent books in political theory and social and political philosophy. Today, I'm talking to Haig Padapan, professor in the School of Government and International Relations at Griffith University. We're discussing his recent book, A Dangerous Passion, Leadership and the Question of Honor, from SUNY Press. His research interests are in contemporary democratic theory and practice, political philosophy, political leadership, and comparative constitutionalism. He is the author of many books and articles on these topics. Okay, well, first of all, Haig Padapan, welcome to the Political Theory Review.
Thank you very much, Jeff. It's a real pleasure and honor.
Wow, good. It's an honor. All right. Well, that's a good transition. You happen to have written a book about honor, which I very much enjoyed reading. It was a great analysis of the concept, a trek through some classic political theory texts on this topic, and a application to some contemporary examples where honor comes up. So hope we could talk about all of those. Maybe you could start off, first of all, just by talking a little bit about what motivated you to write this book in the first place.
Yes, thanks for the opportunity, Jeff. I suppose there were both theoretical and practical reasons. Practically, towards the end of a book on democratic leadership, my colleague and I were talking about democratic leaders and the importance of admiring leaders that do noble jobs as leaders and how we show contempt for them. So the puzzle was, why don't we honor our leaders, and should we honor our leaders, and what price do they pay when they're dishonored? Understandable that we should have some suspicions about them in a liberal sense, but why shouldn't we reward them with distinction beyond money? The other, I think, was the puzzling nature of contemporary scholarship. As you know, as a theorist, honor is a profound and continuing puzzle for thinkers throughout history. But if you look at contemporary scholarship, subject to notable exceptions like Robert Faulkner's Case of Greatness and Liberalism of Honor by Krause, leadership studies just don't address it. And you'll be hard-pressed to find it elsewhere. And I was puzzled by the fact that contemporary scholarship didn't even engage with it. So that's what started the adventure, as it were.
Yeah, that's good. And this is exactly what I was going to ask you as a kind of follow-up, to ask you about the political theory scholarship on it. I mean, I don't know if you had a theory as to why it's understudied. It seems strange because it seems such a core human motivation. But maybe you could say a little bit about, you know, the if you have anything to say about the Krause or the Faulkner books, and kind of where your approach and interest in honor diverges from theirs or builds on them.
Yeah, so if I can just start with your first proposition, why the neglect? So part of the book was to say, well, why is there this neglect? And I think my provisional answer has been to say, if we understand honor as a theoretical concept in contemporary politics from the perspective of the classical Machiavellian and Hobbesian, it strikes me that the predominance of the Hobbesian approach, whereby glory seeking is seen as a kind of sickness, and therefore we try to extirpate it altogether, provides a reason why contemporary scholarship, which is substantially Hobbesian in a variety of ways, of course, shut down the puzzle of honor. It's just too messy, too complicated. You can't number crunch honor. And as the scholars would say, interest is much more understandable. We can calculate it, we can measure it, and power is certainly a consequence of that. So both the Faulkner and the Krause were attempts at recovering a notion of honor, certainly a classical notion, and also trying to revive it in liberalism, because it's essential for liberalism, as Krause was trying to argue. I tried to say, well, it is essential for liberalism, but how does it shape a range of other things, from nationalism to the advice bureaucrats give to their leaders, to identity politics and celebrity politics, and so on, to test my suspicion that contemporary politics was shaped by three predominant views, not the only ones I should underline, but those three I thought were helpful in helping us understand the notion of honor and how it plays out in contemporary politics.
Good. Yeah. So could you maybe just start by talking about the concept of honor, I guess, in general, before we talk about these three different types, the Platonic, Machiavellian, and Hobbesian. But is there something you could say just kind of in general in terms of the concept of honor? One of the things I found very helpful about your book is thinking about honor as having two faces. That is, that it's you're kind of ambivalent about honor in the sense that it can be a source of pride and kind of self-aggrandizing behavior, but it also can be a source of ennoblement, noble actions. So maybe you could say a little bit about the concept in general and how it why it gives rise to these, I guess, two very different kinds of dispositions on the part of human beings.
Yeah. So I think what I should have distinguished at the start was the fact that though there's little discussion of honor in the leadership literature, for example, there is discussion of honor in anthropology, sociology, and so on. But those things tend to be about honor codes, Islamic honor, Japanese honor, and so on, the sort of hierarchy of things that we admire and respect. One thing I discovered reading The Republic was precisely the two faces of honor in a timocratic regime, because ostensibly honor is the same and would not have distinguishing features. But in the discussion with Glaucon, I think Socrates outlines how the honor lover has two dispositions. One is someone who loves honor itself and therefore will defend what is honorable, even to the extent of sacrificing their lives. And another sort of honor lover, which wants to be honored for excellence and therefore wants to be victorious in excellence, but easily can, thus this impulse to be victorious in excellence can easily degenerate to being preeminent in every aspect, and therefore, ironically, becomes an impulse to overturn honor codes in order to be excellent. I think the classic and famous example that we would be familiar with is Alexander the Great, confronted with the puzzle of undoing the knot, the Gordian knot, he just cuts it. And so those sorts of philonychia, I think they're called, will be at the extreme, be tempted to cut the cord or overturn the conventions in order to be preeminent. And this can become so pathological that, as I outline in the book, it even manifests itself in people like Herostratus, who wanted to be so famous that he burnt down the temple of Artemis. So I'll be famous in a bad way because I'm the baddest person in town, becomes an impulse of the honor lover in that face of honor, if I can put it that way. And we can see those two faces, as it were, manifesting themselves in all sorts of imperial and patriotic politics and contemporary politics in all sorts of different ways.
Yeah, I was thinking of the example of Alcibiades, which would have been very close to Socrates, who's clearly an honor lover and willing to kind of, just switch sides in the Peloponnesian War. And Or I mean, this is, I guess, longstanding in Greek tradition. There's Achilles too, who, is it clearly motivated by honor, Achilles, and when the tide swings in the right way, that honor helps the Achaeans. When it swings in the other direction, it can be a real, really destructive. So we can transition to think about Plato, but it seems I'm very apt to take up the Greek example, because it seems that the ancient Greek world was very much attuned to this question of honor, starting with Homer. I don't know if you want to talk about any of that, kind of ancient or classical context of this concept.
Yeah, so the famous discussion by Homer of the character of Achilles and the ambiguity of the choice he makes, the choice between immortal glory and a short life, and the choice he makes. And then, subsequently we find out that he in Hades says, "I made a really bad choice. I really shouldn't have done that. I may have been better off just being a slave in the other world instead of doing that." So an important aspect, I think, from very early poetry, the Greek poets and lyricists and so on, was the connection between honor and immortality, and the extent to which there was the presumption that the gloriousness of honor was related to immortal fame. And this becomes the entry point, I think, for all subsequent thinkers about how rational is that and how plausible is it. And if it's not plausible, how can we genuinely evaluate someone who's going to sacrifice his or her life for their country? I mean, you can do all sorts of rational choice calculations for that, but stepping into the breach where there's no prospect of living seems to be both glorious and extraordinarily foolish thing to do. So why do we admire those very brave and courageous people, and how are we to understand what they're doing becomes the real puzzle for us, I think.
Right. Well, they're losing their lives, and we're not losing ours. You could have selfish motivation for thinking about the admiration.
Yes, and it's only fitting we remember them build monuments to their memory and so on. But this becomes the big puzzle for example, people like Hobbes, who famously starts off by praising Godolphin, who was a poet and died in the Civil War, and he ends the Leviathan praising him again, saying, "What model do we want for our regime, and what model should we celebrate?" And he certainly is celebrating the honor lover who defends honorable things, as opposed to someone who overthrows the honorable. So you can see the different approaches to the Achilles problem by Hobbes and Homer.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, great. So let's talk about Plato. It's kind of where you start with the diving into the three different models or three different modes of thinking about honor, its relationship to statesmanship. Can you discuss what you take to be the Platonic or Socratic teaching about honor that appears in the Republic?
Jeff, I wouldn't presume to be able to do that.
I know, big question.
And it's not false honesty. I just think it's very profound and complicated. And I don't know about you, I think any insight one gains from a dialogue has to be augmented and corrected from the other dialogues. And so it goes on in circles and circles. So excuse me, I'm not trying to get out of answering your question. I'm just placing a lot of caveats on this response. But it does seem, at least from my reading, that there is something in our soul that entangles spiritedness of thumos with eros. And that entanglement produces all sorts of different outcomes for civilians and for statesmen and for philosophers. So I think that, for example, the famous discussion of the philosophic dog, spirited, will protect friends, but dogs really have sometimes hard job knowing who's a friend and enemy. And, you know, Mr. Pavlov has demonstrated how easy it is to make friends with certain dogs. And even that example is ambiguous because Socrates in other works talks about hunting dogs. So it's, dogs aren't just for protection, but you can use them aggressively, you know, to capture prey and so on. And of course, there's the famous Leontius story we're all familiar with, which I think is the counterpart of the Oedipus story. So Leontius actually looks while Oedipus puts his eyes out. And there it's a more ambiguous account of how the relationship between thumos and erotic desire to look. And it seems like a failure of thumos in not being able to employ shame and honor to stop us from looking at things that are disgusting or provocative and so on, but may occasionally warrant for us to look at. And of course, all the other things, curious aspects of thumos, you know, how we personify a chair that we kick our toe on and kick it back, which is a bizarre thing to do. And the extent to which we attribute intentionality to things, you know, the example I have in the book is of Xerxes whipping the river because it wouldn't let him cross it appropriately. So there is something very weird about epithumio thumos, and also something perhaps in the human manifestation of apparently this defensive desire that makes it into an aggressive desire and might explain the two faces of honor.
And maybe a question is that's just sort of about these different parts of the soul that you discuss. I mean, what do you take to be the telos of eros and thumos? Are they the same thing? Are they distinct? I mean, how do you think about the relationship between those two things?
Yeah, this is the most mysterious part, I think, of that discussion. So it's a very good question. I'm not sure I'm able to do justice to it. My initial impulse or attempt to answer your question would be to say that thumos is predominantly defensive until it gets tangled up with our desire of the noble or the beautiful. And when it does do that, then it becomes potentially beautiful in the sense of opening up a philosophical perspective, but also quite dangerous in aspiring for an immortality on earth to be achieved by plonexia, sort of unlimited acquisition. So the entanglement of those two impulses, it seems to me, at least in the Socratic account, opens up the world to philosophy or tyranny for certain people. And insofar as you mentioned Alcibiades before, I think Socrates ultimately had difficulty persuading Alcibiades to pursue a philosophic life. But the evidence suggests that he did moderate Alcibiades. He wasn't as ruthless and cruel as the others were at the time. So education of honor becomes a very important theme in the Republic and in the classical tradition, unlike perhaps subsequent institutional solutions for honor.
Right, and that's good. I mean, the account that you point to as a sort of eros for the noble or the beautiful that can kind of educate honor. You have a discussion of the symposium, which is quite interesting. So you could kind of set side by side the maybe more familiar discussions of honor in the Republic with Leontius and the Timocratic regime and so forth with with an account of the symposium as a, so do you take the symposium account as providing, you know, that account of, you know, maybe Socrates' considered view of how honor can be educated? Or do you think of the Republican Symposium as providing kind of two different alternative ways in which honor can be educated?
Yeah, I, as I said before, I think each dialogue leads to others that will inform and modify and transform each other. So yes, I think all of them should be read at the same time, which shows how difficult this ambition, necessary ambition is. I think the shift, if you look at, let's go back to Alcibiades, his intrusion into the symposium involves Alcibiades moving everyone around. He just, everyone's seated. In other words, the hierarchy's been, and the honorable places have been organized. He comes in and he needs to be the maker of what is honorable rankings in that room. And he can't help himself. He has to do that. Maybe he's done it all his life and so on. But then he's horrified to see Socrates, or at least pretends to be horrified to see Socrates and so on. So there is, in the different accounts of Eros, I think, some explanation of why we, why the impulse, the neediness to know and to have union with the unknown, as it were, manifests itself in certain activities and professions. But in the end, especially in the diatoma, there's this impulse to be joined with the noble, not just now, but for all time, which is a sort of impulse towards immortality, I think. So I think Symposium does reveal certain distinct aspects of honor that perhaps we don't immediately see in Republic.
Right. I mean, one of the this is interesting to me, because I thinking about, I guess, you know, Plato/Socrates' concern, the central concern, I guess, with honor. I mean, honor can be a great support for the regime and connecting individuals to the common good, but it also can be destructive. And it can be destructive, I think, in the way that we've just been sort of talking about, as you know, as a source of tyranny, through kind of trying to remake the world in your own image. But also, maybe you could say a little bit about the you know, the decline of the regimes in Book Eight of the Republic. The Timocratic regime turns into, you know, an oligarchic regime, that is, that you know, it kind of descends into a kind of, you know, selfish self-seeking, becomes maybe cynical, not so interested in, you know, it shows its real face, not interested in great deeds, but interested in the self. You know, so do you see that as kind of a, you know, a distinct kind of concern with honor on Socrates' part, or is that connected?
I think that's a really good question. I think if I can recall it correctly, the honor lover becomes instructive example for their children when they see that the honor doesn't protect them from litigation. So it turns out money is more powerful than the reputation. And this puzzle of which is more important, is money a kind of proof of honor, or is it a reward? And if it's a reward, is it superior to honor, become key problematics for Aristotle in his discussion of magnanimity, I think. Because Aristotle obviously says great-souled individuals want to pursue not money, but honor, because only the gods bestow honor and so on. But then it becomes a bit more complicated, because it seems that honor is bestowed by others who may not be as honorable. So what status does it have if you need to seek it from others, if it's supposed to be a self-sufficient virtue? And again, Should the honorable person not worry about wealth, or should they seek wealth as proof of their honor, reveals the complexity we just noted in the degeneration of the democratic to the oligarchic regime. You know, I don't care what people call me, as long as my bank account is brimming with money, becomes the reasonable counterpoint made by the oligarch to the Timocrat. Now I'll sue you. I'll take all your money. You'll have no reputation, or if you do, it'll be in tatters, or it won't protect you from what I'm going to do to you. So this becomes a perennial struggle, it seems to me, in all regimes between the honor-loving individuals and those, both Democrats and oligarchs, I have to say, who pursue money for comfort and security, obviously, as Machiavelli would say.
Yeah, the Aristotle reference is useful because it makes me think that for the magnanimous man, there's kind of two directions in which that individual can go, because it doesn't seem like a stable kind of character type, because nobody can provide the kind of honors that the magnanimous man thinks he deserves. So he either kind of transcends the community entirely to become some kind of, you know, tyrant, remaking the world in his own image, because no kind of worldly honor can be satisfying, or he descends to accept the honors of the populace, which means that he's going to trip, you know, sully himself with honors like money and so forth, which can be kind of corrupting and turn in that kind of direction. So that face of honor, I think, has two faces itself. Maybe, I'm not sure, but
Or it shows the puzzling nature of the core stability of the concept of honor in politics.
Yeah,
that if it was patently noble and powerful, excuse me, it wouldn't be the sort of ambiguous position, ambiguous virtue that it is, that people praise naturally.
So before we leave the sort of, I guess, Platonic model, do you want to say anything about, I mean, presumably there's a sort of a positive, the positive face to it. I mean, you want to say a little bit about that? I mean, this is sort of a, you know, classical view of statesmanship that kind of emerges here as the ideal that can never quite be realized.
Yeah, I mean, if you look at those people who do grand deeds, but do so for the reputation of excellence rather than for material gain and for simple accrued fame or celebrity, then you understand the foundations of statesmanship, classically understood. So if you are a person of virtue and you want to demonstrate the virtue and you want to show your excellence in virtue and you demonstrate it in the most public and gratifying way, which is statesmanship, then you benefit yourself and the community, and in doing so, reveal your virtuous character. So there is a sort of chain of goodness, I suppose, in that portrayal of the nobility of the glory seeker, who does so not for immediate personal gain, but to demonstrate their character. I think that's the classical understanding of glory as justifiable and noble and ostensibly self-sacrificial, because it may be that those acts will involve sacrifice of those things that we conventionally consider very valuable. For example, our family circumstances, family wealth, careers we may have adopted. One of the characters, one of the leaders I discuss, is Lee Kuan Yew, founder of modern Singapore. And the big argument he has in discussion he has is, you know, he could have been super prosperous as a lawyer, and his members of his family are doctors and so on. Why did he become a leader? You know, why did he sacrifice himself like that? By the way, part of an argument issues in a curious public policy initiative in Singapore, where leaders are paid as much as executives in corporations. So they paid $1 million and more so that they don't lose out, which reveals the puzzle in this equation as we've discussed it.
Well, right. I mean, it's commercial society. I mean, this is not a new insight. Many have said this, but commercial society, at least modern commercial society, at least aimed to try to harness the power of glory seeking, right? And CEOs are paid handsomely, and this is a route to glory and honor is through big business. But if capitalism sucks away all the all the glory seekers, then politics is left with few. So yeah, I guess suppose you do have to pay handsomely in order to draw the honor seeker back to you. I mean, I guess that maybe makes a nice transition to Machiavelli, who's your second provides your kind of second model of thinking about honor and its relationship to leadership. Of course, Machiavelli comes after and in response to a kind of Christian critique of honor, which should be noted that. What I mean, the idea that honor belongs to God and God alone, and so the idea of human beings as sort of glory or honor seekers is something to be denigrated. So Machiavelli, in a sense, tries to rehabilitate honor or glory. Maybe you could say a little bit about how you conceive of how the Machiavellian model is distinct from the classical model.
You're absolutely right. At least from my reading, he does try to recover glory, as he says, because our religion has glorified the humble and the contemplative, as he puts it. And he thinks glory is essential for politics, especially for Republican politics. So he does want to recover a notion of glory. But it's complicated by his analysis of the humours, as we all know in Machiavelli's discussion, that he takes up medieval humors but shrinks them into two dominant ones. And it turns out that the few want to oppress and the many don't wish to be oppressed. And this sets up a perennial pathological situation in republics where glory feeds into this perpetual struggle of license and domination and tyranny. So he needs to, in a way, use glory to counter glory, if I can put it that way, because he doesn't appeal to classical education, he doesn't appeal to Christian beatitudes or education, the virtues or pieties. He wants to use the poison of glory against itself. So the greatest glory, of course, is the glory of the founder of a wholly new place. That's why in subsequent chapters, I use Lee Kuan Yew as an example of someone who tries to do this. But the puzzle then becomes, how can glory achieve this if Machiavelli doesn't have a comprehensive understanding of virtue, except in an instrumental sense, as it were. And I think he thinks glory can do this because it seems to be the passion that is self-interested, but necessarily other-directed. So it's a mediated passion, unlike perhaps, for example, eating. We can satisfy our desire for fine foods by just going and eating it by ourselves. We don't need company. Company might enhance it, but it's not essential or necessary. But we can't do that with glory. And here, the complexity, I think, is the importance that fear plays in psychology. Because as far as I could tell, Eros, deprived of virtue, cannot do the same thing in Machiavellian glory that it does in classical thinking. So consequently, Machiavelli wants to intervene in the struggles between the grandee and the popoli, in order to found a Republican regime that can sustain itself. And so that means elevating glory as the reward for the few, but making sure that the few do not oppress the many. And this is the provocative and disturbing part of Machiavelli's teaching. So the glory as a humor has to manifest itself somewhere, and it manifests itself in international empire and conquests that are in turn reward the populi, because everyone loves a winner. And of course, victory will forget all sorts of sins, as he says. And the prosperity of the many will again redound to the glory of the glorious founder and leader. And so the problem of glorying is solved in that particular material way, as opposed to the classical understanding of a public demonstration of otherwise invisible virtues.
Yeah, this is great. I was curious about the sort of, you know, maybe you could say kind of populist element maybe in Machiavelli. This has been, I guess, emphasized in some recent scholarship on Machiavelli. I think like John McCormick has, you know, kind of like a very democratized view of Machiavelli. Maybe don't go that far, but at least there is this strand of in Machiavelli of thinking about how, right, that the few oppress the many, and so the best way to get a stable regime is to have not the few oppress the many, but just one hold off the oppression of the many and uphold the many against even against the few. The discourses, I think, make this even more clear. So, I mean, am I right to you talk about Lee Kuan Yew, and I think in the context, I don't know if you had any other thoughts about, you know, kind of like similar. There's been a lot of sort of populist leadership, populist sentiment, you know, Trump or Viktor Orban or any, you know, I'm not sure if you have any thoughts about that, but are they profitably analyzed in this context or not?
Well, it really depends on, I suppose, the institutional structures we're going to introduce to make sure that. In the book, I say Machiavelli's notion of glory leads to charismatic leadership and to elite leadership, scholarship, contemporary scholarship. So depends on how you want to use those sub scholarships to assess contemporary circumstances. But in terms of institutions, I think you helpfully alluded to the fact that you want a struggle between the few to be judged by the many. So you don't want the few to impose their cruelties on the many to gain their glory. So you need to divert that impulse, I think, the Machiavellian impulse, which goes to the real puzzle of why the few would want to oppress. What is it? What is the source of this impulse? And I think the classical understanding would point to some notion of erotic longing. And I suspect for Machiavelli, at least from my reading, it's based on fear that, you know, the famous account of the birds capturing the birds when they look up, there's a bigger bird above them, like eagles and hawks and what have you. It's the sense that if I don't get my retaliation in first, I'll be at a loss. So if politics is riven by fear, then management of fear becomes one of the essential institutional requirements. And where this fear originates from becomes a problem for Machiavelli, but certainly the suggestion is, if it wasn't for fear, politics would not exist. We wouldn't join each other, the floods, you know, the starvation and so on, that force people into communities. So Machiavelli's account, I think, raises questions about the naturalness of politics and therefore the ambiguous relationship of individuals who try to dominate and not be dominated and so on.
Yeah, it's good. The psychology reminds me a little bit of Hobbes's psychology, of course, driven by fear, which motivates individuals to seek power after power and unto death. And so maybe we could transition to that as your third model of thinking about honor and statesmanship. Interestingly, you contrast, I mean, despite the similarities between Machiavelli and Hobbes, you contrast their models. I think you call Machiavelli kind of a vertical view of honor and leadership, whereas Hobbes is more of a horizontal view of honor and leadership. Maybe you could explain that metaphor.
Yeah, so what struck me was my starting point was that, you know, if we talk about the moderns, presumably they would all have the same views about honor. But as I tried to indicate, at least very in a very sketchy way in the discussion of identity politics, but certainly in the context of Hobbes, there are fundamental differences between the Machiavellian and Hobbesian understanding of honor and glory. And you helpfully pointed out the different impulses and understandings of Hobbes of why human beings enter into conflict, you know, anything from diffidence to competitiveness to glory seeking. But as I tried to argue in the book, it turns out the most irrational is glory seeking because of this core confusion whereby you try to show the importance of your dignity by actually dying for it. And he says this is simply irrational and shows you how potentially unlimited glorying is by getting armies together to prove this on a grand scale, not just the madness in the individual, because there's a certain joy, he says. There's a certain pleasure in thinking that you're big. You know, people with normal bodies end up building big palaces because they want to think that their bodies are that big for the palace, which shows the absurdity of this joy, the pleasure of expanding and being big. And so glorying becomes the pathological desire, pathological emotion that he needs to extirpate. And he does this using certain techniques. But I think what I tried to suggest in the book is one of the most important is to completely redefine and sever the connection between honor and virtue. So honor is a measure of power and not virtue. It doesn't mean anything else. It shows you your honor. It shows you how powerful you are. So when someone walks into the room and no one stands up, you know how powerful you are. And when people stand up, when you walk into a room, well, that gives you something else, irrespective of the virtue you may have. Because as he says, when it comes to the notion of honor, we're price takers, not price givers. So the market determines our honor and therefore our power. And that shows the horizontal aspect that you mentioned just now, that how we determine influences and whether they are influences is determined by how many likes others register on their websites, which is wholly determined by all the bizarre reasons all the like people endorse in liking you. You don't know why. And some really good people may have almost no likes. And this shows you the slippery nature of the web-like connections of honor and power in Hobbes's account, I think. He certainly wants to destroy presumptions of the aristocratic who say we are honorable because we did grand things or we have a grand bloodline and so on. He takes particular relish in humiliating them.
Right. So yeah, I mean, this is the aristocrats are a great source of conflict and instability in the regime. So there is a similarity with Machiavelli, that is the few are troublesome, seek power, and so there needs to be a kind of, you know, squashing of the few and more of an emphasis on the many and in politics. So I can see how, you know, in the Hobbesian view, it's sort of more a democratizing way of thinking about honor, that honor is more spread out. But I mean, I suppose one way of thinking, and again, I mean, this is, I guess, one standard view is thinking about Hobbes and Machiavelli as closer maybe than you're suggesting, that you know, the Hobbesian Leviathan, what happens to the Hobbesian Leviathan? Doesn't honor get absorbed in the Hobbesian Leviathan rather than extirpated? Can you ever really extirpate that desire for glory? Doesn't it have to go somewhere?
Yeah, this was a puzzle for me too, Jeff. I thought, you know, this is Locke's famous critique of Hobbes, right? You know, the lion taking over the place instead of the poleaxes and what, you know, polecats, not poleaxes. So, yeah, in the book, I suggest one possibility that may be in the spirit of what I've just suggested, which is the discussion of the geese, you know, the Roman geese, 4th century BC, where they save the empire because they in their noise, they reveal the problem of the attack. And so there's no one there, in other words. We may not need anyone to be a Leviathan as a person. And if we set up institutions accordingly, we can do away with the danger of glorying altogether. Now, certainly his defense of monarchy didn't help his cause in that way. But if you remember that he also says that the monarch can be made up of one, few, or many. So a democratic Leviathan can assume that role. And if you see individuals as defenders of rights, as in rights established by the social contract, then they become honor seekers in a more defensive way, not the aggressive way. So the system becomes an institution where it defends itself honorably. I'm always reminded of my travels through America, where people assert their rights. And when they're asserting their rights, they're not being glory seekers. They're actually defending the Constitution because it gives them certain rights. And in defending their rights to be first in the queue or whatever, they're being patriots in a way. Admittedly, in a contractual sense of, you know, I want my seat on the plane or I want my hotel booking, whatever, which seems embarrassing and awkward and all the rest, but it gives them a certain courage to make those claims because it has larger implications and significations within the Republic. So yes, it can potentially lead to one glorying, but it can also lead to institutional structures. And finally, I think it's helpful for us to recall the extensive education that Hobbes tries to provide to the sovereign about what you should do. And it's not just a sort of classical Christian Erasmus education of the Christian prince or anything like that. It's something like, look, if you don't do this stuff, they're going to kill you. Some other sovereign's going to come in. And your wealth is dependent upon the wealth of your citizens. So make sure you look after them. All these sort of Hobbesian counsel is designed to advise the smart authoritarian about how to run the regime.
Right. Your discussion about Americans and the love of the rule of law and individual rights, you know, that makes good sense of, I guess, I mean, in a certain way, it seems what you're doing is suggesting, you know, in modern democracies, you know, in the democratization of honor in the modern age, it can go in kind of two different directions. That is the Machiavellian direction or the Hobbesian direction. That is, you know, the kind of Machiavellian populism can give rise to a single populist leader who can kind of wreak havoc. On the other hand, you know, democracies can, you know, give rise to certain, I mean, it's a sort of democratic code of honor, right? That is like our Bill of Rights. That is, it gives, instead of enshrining certain kind of honor and rights and privileges to just particular individuals, it just happens to be for everyone. And then everyone is jealous. And that's kind of appealing. I'm not sure if that strikes a chord with you, if you want to comment on that, but it points me, I think, to your chapter on nationalism and patriotism, which I think is connected here in thinking about how honor can kind of manifest itself, especially in democracies, and especially in this kind of two-faced way that that patriotism can be honorable, but it can also be kind of pernicious. So if you want to come on that too.
Yeah. So I think your initial observation is very helpful. I would just add the importance of constitutional and rule of law in the democratic arrangement. So you are protecting the original agreement, as it were, which is different from the Machiavellian, where there is no agreement of that sort. And that provides a sort of modification to the glory seeking of individuals, because the highest becomes this puzzling thing, which is the constitution founded by the people. So the circularity, leaving aside the circularity of that argument, you're always defending the rule of law in the constitution, which has the highest honor and dignity in the regime. In terms of nationalism, I tried to understand how these three different ways of approaching the honor leadership dynamic, how that might explain things like nationalism, patriotism, and so on. And my provisional thinking on that is that while traditional or classical patria is restrained by the land, we're born of the land, and Socrates famously tries to ennoble it by saying, yeah, but we're all brothers, so there's no distinction there. And, you know, some of us are different. We have gold, some is, and so on. So let's not become aristocratic in a weird way. Let's introduce virtues in it. I think the shift from that notion of patria, of land, to a contract, which is what we were talking about before, raises big problems. So obviously the contract is intended to remove the pathologies of a land-based patria notion of who and what we are. But on the other hand, and in doing so, anyone can form a contract, right? This is Hobbes's claim. You can have a social contract irrespective of the land, as it were, and your affinity to it. On the other hand, as I suggest in that chapter, it's very hard to love a contract. And as Nietzsche famously said, the modern state is a cold monster. There's a coldness about the contract. So it's hard to die for a contract. It's easier, I think, to think of dying for your country, or, you know, sacrificing for your country. But for a contract that seems, and especially one that I've made, that seems like an odd thing to do. So I suggest that nationalism is a response to this coldness problem, whereby the warmth of patria is taken up, but now removed from its safety of being linked to the land and shifted to other amorphous concept, whether it be blood or language or race, whatever it may be. So it takes up, as it were, the worst of both aspects. Nationalism has the potential to be toxic, exploited by populists, as you noted before.
Yeah, I'm curious about, what maybe a different alternative, which is to think about, the contract and constitution, basic law, as holding out a kind of unfinished moral project, as opposed to just some kind of agreement that we always kind of turn, hey, do you remember what we agreed to back then? But something like, it's a sort of Abraham Lincoln-esque thinking about how, you know, America is always in the process of perfecting itself, that's what we've agreed to. And that's something that can arouse a certain love, but that is a kind of moral aspiration, as opposed to just, sort of filling it in with kind of blood and soil. So I think of that as a kind of maybe, and I don't know what you think, but as a kind of another alternative in modernity. I've spent some time thinking about Kant, for example. Kant talks a lot about honor. He kind of likes it, and so he has an ambivalent attitude about it, kind of in the way that you're sketching, that it can be kind of destructive to the moral life, but it can also be sort of a vehicle vehicle towards it, it can arouse our interest in freedom and virtue. So I don't know if you thought about that sort of, you know, a kind of moral path not taken in modernity as a way to sort of ground nationalism or patriotism.
Yeah, look, I share your concerns about the superiority of the social contract approach in trying to moderate the excesses that we've been talking about as opposed to the nationalist dimension. But it strikes me the core problem, besides the coldness and your attempt to make it warmer, I suppose, by talking about the unending project, is it always comes back, it strikes me, to the ways of amending constitutions. And this, the amendment procedures point out the core puzzle, it seems to me, of the dignity, sanctity, and honor of the written document. Was it devised by certain people at a certain time, and therefore we should be able to change it according to our circumstances? Or was it devised and conceived in a complete and comprehensive way, and therefore we should not change it at all, or do so in after much deliberation, not to repair it, not to improve upon it, but to repair contemporary poor applications of it, or something like that? So where the amendments are returning to the original sanctity and beauty according to contemporary exigencies, or actually, as you put it, progressing continually, reveals the dilemma of our involvement in lawmaking. And for Kant, I think just the fact that we were lawmakers gave us dignity. I mean, insofar as they were general, that was sufficient. Becomes the problem of anthropology about what is the substance of the law and so on. And the whole natural law tradition raises problems with this. You know, how can you have an unjust law and what does that mean, et cetera, without an eternal law and a divine law? But these different notions, as I suggest in that chapter, are all alive at the same time. The patria, citizenship tests always say, were you born in this country or on a ship, or did you acquire citizenship through a green card and what have you? There's the nationalism, you know, China dream, as I say in that chapter, of China dream of rejuvenation because China has been humiliated in the 19th century, early 20th century. And also that all these places have been instituted by agreement. So we have a constitution that we have to defer to, and we're not going to do anything else unless we change the constitution. So it's, I really want to emphasize the fact that it's all muddled and complicated by these different conceptions of what is a good citizen and therefore what is a good leader.
Right. Yeah. So I wanted to finish up by, you know, hitting more squarely on the, you know, really the, you know, the other main motivation in your book, which is to think about how honor can be understood in the context of leadership and good leadership. So I guess the short answer, the short version of the question is how do the three different models and of thinking about honor and statesmanship and help inform leadership today? You know, I guess the, you know, slightly longer version of the question is that there's a big, you know, leadership studies industry, which you discuss in one of the chapters here. And I suppose there is some attention in that literature and thinking about leadership that leaders do pursue something like esteem or status. I guess, you know, that there's no use of the language of honor. But how do you think that your book and your way of approaching honor can help, you know, improve our thinking about leadership, and then I guess hopefully the practice of contemporary leadership more broadly?
Yeah. I guess insofar as the contemporary leadership industry, as you put it, continually emphasizes horizontal structures, participatory and deliberative practices, which are all worthwhile. And so I'm not being critical of it, but don't acknowledge the role of individuals who will pursue excellence and therefore seek distinction as opposed to being awarded equally the prizes as in the dodo race, you know, in the famous account. I think in order to, in a Hobbesian spirit, avoid the dangerous glory seekers, we've forgotten the usefulness of honor as a distinction for virtue. So if nothing else, I'm trying to suggest to the leadership industry that acknowledging excellence in virtue actually is very good, not just for corporations, but for politics generally. So we should be vigilant, we should be careful to assess the merits of leaders in the liberal spirit. We should be suspicious of them, cautious and all the rest, but we should also be open to the possibility that we should praise them and admire their achievements. And that seems kind of simple-minded, I suppose. But if you think about the extent to which there are public-spirited individuals who will sacrifice their careers to enter into office and endure all sorts of humiliations, destroy their, or put at risk their family lives and so on to do good for their country, at the very least, we should reward them with the distinction of honor, of we should acknowledge their virtue. And if Aristotle is correct, that's what they're really looking for, above all, to display their virtue in the most magnificent way and to be acknowledged for it. And I think the suggestion, at least towards the end of the book, is that if we do that, the democratic politics will become better, not just more honorable, but healthier, as opposed to seeing it as just a sort of a dogfight with my dog winning and yours losing and so on.
Right. I've been thinking about the Republican Party in American politics in the wake of Trump. And, you know, it's interesting because a lot of Republican leaders seem to just have kind of followed the sort of Trump bandwagon. But there have been some, I mean, most notably Liz Cheney, I guess, was, you know, is a good example of someone who really seemed to kind of sacrifice herself and her career, really, in order to kind of stand up for what's right. And what, you know, one might say, you know, honor and distinction to her, right? And if we had maybe more of a culture of doing that, maybe things would be a little bit more different in the Republican Party. I'm not sure. I don't know if that's a good example, but that's at least what comes to mind.
That's an excellent example. And actually what it reveals is another puzzling aspect of the whole honor discussion, which is how will history judge me? Because all leaders are interested in history. They will write books, they want to leave testaments to their excellence and so on. So how will Cheney be judged in 5 years, 10 years, 50 years time? Will she emerge heroically, as it were, as one of the few who resisted the impulse to win at any cost? Or will the Republic have been so transformed that those debates will not matter anymore, become fascinating test cases, I suppose, of the trajectory of the Republic?
Well, Haig, this has been a lot of fun. I really enjoyed discussing this topic and your book with you. So thanks again for joining me on the Political Theory Review.
Thanks, Jeff. I really enjoyed your questions and learned a lot from them.
You've been listening to the Political Theory Review. Find us on the web and on iTunes. Thanks to the Starting Points Journal for partnering with us. And thanks to you for listening.